change is black and white. Ain't that simple? It's hard to tell who's wrong or right. When it's dark with us, I swear I barely see the light. Should I stick it out? Are you worth this fight? Are we worth this fight? Cause I ain't no quitter, babe. And I've been down the floor these years. I thought you dissed me, babe. I was there when no one wanted to stay with you, baby. If I make it through hell and I come out alive, I got nothing to fear. No more crying and trying to bring back the loving when nothing is here. Let me be clear, I wasn't perfect, but this ain't worth it. I'm done with the mess. I confess I'm distressed and I know I'ma look back and call it a blessing.
Ain't no quitter, babe. No quitter, babe. And I've been down for these years. I thought you dissed me, babe. No. I was there when no one wanted to stay with you, babe.
In the morning, and the best mix of R&B. 103.5 WRBO-FM, Como Memphis, a Cumulus station.
Welcome to Positively Memphis. I'm your host, Christy Taylor, and today we are gearing up for a lot of historical events this year. MLK 50. Of course, we've had some great things that happened in the city that have historical significance, and today I'm about to learn about an amazing project that's happening here in Memphis called the Lynching Sites Project of Memphis, and to help me discuss that, we have the Executive Director, John Ashworth, and also retired professor from the University of Memphis, Margaret Vandenberg. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, I'm extremely new to the Lynching Sites Project of Memphis, so I'm looking forward to discussing that. But before we get into that, I want to get to know who you two are. And I think we're going to go with ladies first. Margaret Vandenberg, PhD, retired professor. Tell me a little bit about yourself. Are you from Memphis? If not, how did you get here? And then how did you get into this work?
I grew up in Florida, and I did my graduate work at Florida State University. And when I began searching for an academic job, there was an opening at the University of Memphis, and I came and interviewed and took the job and was there for about 23 years.
Now, of course, I see that I was in criminology and criminal justice. So tell me about that.
My area of specialization was capital punishment, and I became more and more interested in the history of the death penalty. As I studied that, it began to overlap more and more with lynchings. Mm. The legal executions and the extra-legal executions had many similarities. So I began to also look more deeply into the history of lynching, particularly in Shelby County and in some other counties of Northwest Tennessee.
Wow. So I can see the journey to participating with this. So how did you get involved with the Lynching Sites Project?
Well, I had written a book that was published in 2006, and I have to say it did not receive a great deal of interest. But then in late 2015, I was contacted by the Lynching Sites Project, which was just getting set up at that point, and they had stumbled on a copy of my book and asked if I would assist them with research. And, of course, I was delighted that someone was interested in the cases and in commemorating these crimes that were committed.
Wow, that's amazing. So that leads us to Mr. John Ashworth, the Lynching Sites Project of Memphis. You are the executive director. Tell me about yourself. Okay, recently named. Well, before we get into that, tell me about yourself. Are you from Memphis? If not, how did you get here?
No, I was born in Middle Tennessee, Lebanon, Tennessee. My father came to West Tennessee, Brownsville, as a matter of fact, had his career there. My mother died when from birth, and I moved down with him after my grandfather died. So I grew up in Brownsville, Tennessee, went to school, graduated in 61, went to Tennessee State University. After Tennessee State University, I had a 21-year career in the military. I'm a Vietnam veteran.
Okay, thank you for your service.
After retiring from the military, I went to work for the airlines and worked 20 years in commercial aviation and management. Retired from that in 2005, and in 2007, I moved back to Brownsville, Tennessee. My stepmother was still living then. But one of my passions and interests has always been African-American history. So I moved back and began doing some work with a doctor later. They graduated high school with me, a Dr. Granberry. And we actually founded a small museum based on African-American history. And our focus was to look at African-American history from the standpoint of how they use their native intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
The history has done a very good job of telling what happened to African-Americans. History, I don't think, has done nearly as good a job of saying how they use their native intelligence to make their way in the world. And then that one thing led into another. And then there's a retired attorney out of Crockett County, Tennessee, Jim Emerson, who began doing research on a lynching that took place in Brownsville. And he contacted me, and I started working, and we've been working now probably 4 or 5 years. It was on the lynching of a man by the name of Elbert Williams, who was lynched in 1940. And then we did the work, we did a commemoration. And then in late 2016, the Lynching Sites Project somehow heard about me, I think perhaps through Jim Emerson, because I was the chair of the Elbert Williams Memorial Committee. And they reached out to me because they wanted to do the 100-year commemoration for a lynching here in Memphis of L. Persons. And I came on board and was a project manager. And in May of 2017, we had a very, very good commemoration of the L. Persons lynching. We had a little over 500 people there. We had both the city, the county mayor. We had Congressman Cohen. And so we were very successful with that. And the Lynching Sites Project, and we're getting into that, the Lynching Sites Project came about as a result of, I don't know if you're familiar with Equal Justice Initiative out of Montgomery, Alabama, that was started by a man by the name of Brian Stevenson. But nonetheless, they have set out to they did the research to document lynchings that occurred throughout the United States from right after the Civil War on up until about the 1950s, I think it is. Mm-hmm. They documented a little bit over 4,000 that occurred. Brian Stevenson did a presentation to the people here in Memphis and said to them, Shelby County, you had more lynchings as a county in Tennessee than any other county, and you really need to do something here. And with that, they formed the Lynching Sites Project, and this is back in 2015. And that's about when they brought Dr. Van Diver on, because EJI had discovered, I think at that time, 21 lynchings that they knew about. Through her work, we're now up to 36. And the work is continuing. And we know that, even with the 36, even with the 4,000, that's really just the tip of the iceberg. But it, and why this is important is it's how understanding what happened then informs us about where we are today.
Correct. Okay, so I was about to get to that point on how does the history of lynching, and particularly in the climate that we're in, intersect in the 21st century?
Well, I think it's extremely pertinent. I believe it's the Virginia Supreme Court heard this week a case of whether hanging the effigy of a black man by a noose in your front yard is covered speech under the First Amendment or whether it's a hate crime. I have been appalled in the last year or so by the number of times that nooses have been used to threaten and intimidate African Americans. It's a symbol that still has tremendous, tremendous emotional force. So it's relevant in that way. It's also relevant in a number of social practices that still exist. In the last 8 or 10 years, social scientists have begun doing research correlating historic patterns of lynching with current practices. I want to be clear that this is not an easy cause-effect relationship. This is very complex research that involves a lot of variables over long historic periods. But they have found correlations between historic patterns of lynching, the modern use of executions, imposition of death sentences, support for capital punishment among whites, housing segregation, homicide patterns in the South, hate crime enforcement, and a number of other issues. So this has not gone away. It may be manifesting itself in different ways, but it's still very present.
Okay, so therein lies, you know.
Well, you know, and adding to that, you know, if you go back and you think about it, you ask the question, how does that, I think, inform today? Let me give you an example. In 1917, when L. Persons here in Memphis was lynched and murdered.
Now, let's talk about who he was.
Let me get the history on that then, and maybe I need to defer because she really did the detailed research, and if I talk, I'm talking her. Okay, she wanted me to go. The case was, in May of 1917, there was a young white girl by the name of Antoinette Rappel, and this happened out, you know, where the Summer Drive in out near the Wolf River. She came up missing, and they found her body near the bridge. She had been decapitated. She, of course, murdered, decapitated, and they determined she had been sexually violated. And the evidence that was present on the scene seemed to indicate that it was a white person who did that because of the nature of the evidence that was there. And so that's what the law enforcement thought. So they started looking. But there was a man by the name of L. Person who was a woodcutter who was working for some people, and he made a remark to the man and his wife that he had a dream about the wife. And that husband, in turn, said to the sheriff that this could be the one. And almost foregoing all the evidence was there, they turned their attention to him and actually picked him up and arrested him. Could not determine that he did it, released him. And, of course, they continued. But by now, we're talking about 1917. There is an outcry for something. And since this black man has now come to their attention, that obviously has to be the one. That's just the climate they lived in. They took him to Nashville. And finally indicted, was going to have a trial, and the plan was to bring him back through, I think, Alabama, Mississippi, back into Memphis. Mob found out about it and intercepted them somewhere in Mississippi and took L. Persons from the law enforcement people, carried him back to the site where the murder took place, where Antoinette Rappel was killed. And it was a public spectacle. There was a little over 5,000 people who showed up for the lynching. That's the way a lot of lynchings were done. They were spectacle lynchings. And they actually staked him to the ground. They were going to hang him first, but then they decided, no, he needs to have a horrible death. They staked him to the ground alive, doused his body with gas, oil, set him on fire, and after he is dead, and I realize this is graphic, but after he's dead, his body was disfigured. His head was cut off, taken, and thrown at people down on Beale Street. And there are actual pictures of that. But that's an extra legal, as she talks about, that's an extra legal judicial or lynching that takes place.
Wow. Wow.
Yes.
So, 1917. Okay, so that brings us back up to...
And to come back and to tie this back into where we're going now. And let me say this. We all know the song, Lift Every Voice and Sing. And
correct.
We all know that James Weldon Johnson was the author of that song. What very few of us realize is that James Weldon Johnson in 1917 was the field secretary for the NAACP.
Mm.
James Weldon Johnson actually came to Memphis as a part of the investigation about what happened on behalf of the NAACP. James Weldon Johnson went out to where this lynching actually occurred, and after this that he wrote, among other things, he wrote that he had come to the conclusion that the problem of race in America was the saving of black bodies and white, saving of black Americans' bodies and white Americans' soul.
Mm.
That statement is as true today mm-hmm. as was uttered then. And I was on the radio on another program in Brownsville this morning, and I said, you know, when you looked at that, in 1917, we had that. Here we are in 2017. We have the Philando Castile case, which I think is probably the most graphic. We have the video. We have every action that the officer took. We have every action that Philando Castile took. We have the video from his girlfriend. So we've got it from two angles. We know what happened. And yet we can't get a conviction.
Mm-hmm.
So that says that, wait a minute, we still have a problem. You know, and I'm thinking, I don't want to go too far and take away from her, but in 1983, I think it was, there was a lynching. I think it was Lee Walsh here in Memphis. The mob took him from the jail. 1893.
Lee Walker.
Okay, tell me about that very quickly.
Lee Walker was apparently a transient from Mississippi who had some sort of an encounter with two young white women in East Shelby County. His account was that he was hungry and asked them for food. Their account was that he sexually assaulted or attempted to assault them. He was brought into downtown Memphis and put in the jail, and a mob was more or less allowed to take him out of the jail and to hang him in downtown Memphis. After he was hanged and was dead, his body was burned, cut down, dragged through the streets, and left in front of the courthouse. So this was an absolutely disgraceful spectacle in the middle of downtown Memphis.
And that was in
1893.
In July.
And the really interesting part is that the white powers that be in the city of Memphis actually indicted the sheriff and two of the deputies for allowing the mob to come in. Now, I say that to put that in contrast without being unable to get a conviction in 2016, 2017 in the cases of Philando Castile, Tamir Rice, you know, on and on and on. So that's why this discussion about lynchings is so important, because all of us need to go back and understand the history of what it is. You know, one of the things that I said this morning is that as we try and find solutions to all of these urban problems, all of us are operating, whether you went to a white school or a black school, all of us are operating on a false sense of what history actually was.
Mm.
It is important to get right what actually happened, because that informs a great deal of where we are today.
I have a question.
Okay.
In regards to this. Now, lynching as we are discussing it.
Yes.
You know, we're saying started in 18...
They actually are documented lynchings pre-Civil War, and many of the victims of those lynchings were white. It was after right. the Civil War that African Americans became the primary targets, and lynching really took on this aspect of racial terrorism that's what we mainly associate with it now. And in Shelby County, we have, in fact, 7 white victims of lynching, as
okay.
well as African Americans.
So pre-Civil War, it was almost like the crucifixion. Just a form of capital punishment?
In a sense, that's correct. It's sometimes called rough justice. This wasn't so much the case in Shelby County, but in many parts of the country, there were not really fully functioning legal systems at that time. And you see this a lot in the West. Someone
the
was
Wild Wild
rustling
West.
Cattle, and he was simply executed on the spot by a group. So that kind of lynching is another extrajudicial execution, certainly, but it's not precisely the type of lynching that we see in the South, where it was a very calculated right. form of racial intimidation and control.
Yeah, that was my question
right.
in reference to, of course, we know pre-Civil War, mm-hmm. it was slavery.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So it was the owning of the black bodies, and there was various ways of discipline.
And understand part of what transpired. When the country finishes the Civil War, you now have this huge population of former slaves who
Correct.
Are now free people. So you no longer have access to their labor.
And to their bodies.
And to their bodies. And yet you need them. As a matter of fact, you know, we often hear, we've all heard it, the 40 acres and a mule.
Correct.
Well, the actual history behind that 40 acres and a mule is that after Sherman completes his march from Atlanta to the sea, there's this huge, you know, literally thousands of former slaves who have followed the Union Army down to Savannah. So when Sherman gets to Savannah, the question is, what do I do with all these people who have nothing? They have the clothes on the back, some are old, infirm, they're ill, what have you. Well, anyhow, with the Lincoln administration, what they eventually say to Sherman is meet with them and ask them what they need. And there's a group of 40 black ministers who actually meet with General Sherman and Stanton, who is Lincoln's Secretary of War. And they say to them, if the entire conversation is documented, but the spokesman says to Sherman, give us land and we can take care of ourselves and pretty soon be able to contribute something to the Union, as well as some of our young men can join the Union. And Sherman reports this back to Lincoln and they approve it. And they actually set aside land from the St. John's River in Florida, 30 miles in, all the way up to just south of Charleston. And that's literally 400,000 acres of land. And Sherman knew that the war, because he's got to go on to Virginia, accept a surrender. So he knows that at the end of this, he is going to have an excess of horses. So what he says when Lincoln approves the 400,000 acres of land, he says, well, you know, we can make the horses available, which is where, and the way they base that is basically 40 acres of land per family. I mean,
Correct.
Just kind of use that as a measurement. So they've given 40 acres, and now you've got this horse. But Lincoln gets assassinated. And this plan, and that gets repealed. Johnson returns the land to the former plantation owners.
And so was that the incident?
That's the incident that sets all of that up. And now there's a need for the labor. Now they go into this negotiation.
Sharecropping.
And that's where sharecropping comes from.
And if I could add one thing to that, the convict lease system,
right.
which developed after the Civil War, was really an open effort to re-enslave people. It was
the 13th Amendment.
An effort
13th Amendment.
Under which anyone could be picked up as a vagrant and sold to the state or to a private contractor. And some of the most brutal work done across the South was done by these convicts, the mining, the turpentine extraction.
Right.
The building of railroads under the most terrible conditions imaginable.
The chain gang.
The chain gang was actually a little later under
okay.
state control. The convict lease system generally used private contractors, so sometimes it's in
which was basically
Tennessee.
Former plantation owners?
Well, often it was, or people who were entrepreneurs and saw a way to get rich very
as in the current
quickly.
Industrial prison complex.
Exactly.
It ties in very closely.
Wow.
And it's also interesting to me that one of the first, perhaps the very first leasors in Tennessee was none other than Nathan Bedford Forrest.
Which, of course, we just recently had a very strategic approach to the removal mm-hmm. of his statue, and eventually they're going to relocate mm-hmm. him and his wife's body back to
where he initially went, Elmwood Cemetery.
Yeah, yes, which, of course, understand that immediately after his death, that's where he was buried, and then in the 1950s?
That's where he wanted to be buried.
That was a prestigious cemetery.
Yes.
Right. Right.
Wow. Okay, so I'm seeing more and more of the parallels because, honestly, in the 21st century, other than there are some 20th century and even recently mm-hmm. Reports of the nooses, but as far as the historical perspective. Most people are like, we're dealing with police brutality. We're dealing with this. Why do we need to concern ourselves with lynching? But even with Ava DuVernay, filmmaker Ava DuVernay, who did the 13th Amendment movie, it really does show the parallel on how you basically continue slavery through that particular principle.
Yes. And I think it's important to note how, although the particular form of things changes over time, the incarceration of African Americans, and you can almost look at slavery as a truly a mass incarceration.
Correct.
And the extraction of forced labor or the forced removal from the ability to do productive work are themes that run through a great deal of American history.
Oh, my goodness. This is so good. This is so good. Okay, you know, Mr. John.
There's a book that I mean, in fact, a couple of books I'd recommend everybody to read. One is by Dr. James Cone. He is a faculty member at the Union University in New York, Divinity School. He's written a book. It's a very, very good book called The Cross and the Lynching Tree. And he draws a parallel, because when you look at the crucifixion,
correct,
it's really a lynching.
Correct.
And it's not that different. He says if you can't understand lynching, you really, really can't understand a crucifixion.
My goodness.
There's another lady by the name of Dr. Joy DeGruy who has written a book called Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome. The essence of this book, what the essence of this book says is that African Americans have gone through 400 years of trauma without any intervention. Now, the other side of that is that whites have gone through 400 years of cognitive dissonance without any intervention. So nobody is unaffected by this stuff. To do what you did to a person that you knew was a human, you had to go through some process in your mind to say that this is not a human. And that condition for 400 years has been passed on. So both sides have to come to the table and have this very, very difficult conversation if we're going to begin to attack a lot of the ills of this country.
Let's talk about Memphis, Shelby County in regards to the trauma and the dissonance. So we're here, 21st century.
21st century.
Nathan Forrest and his statue, the very fact that some young African-American males and probably a lot of behind-the-scenes powerful people found a way to go against the Tennessee Historical Commission. Here at the same time, you all are doing the Lynching Sites Project in a city that historically was very, very egregious toward people of color.
Correct.
Where are we in the conversation? Because you say these two people have to sit down at the table and have this conversation about the fact there has not been an intervention. So where are we right now, politically, socially, emotionally, mentally? Where are we?
My sense is that there are a lot of good people in Memphis, both black and white, who really do want to have this conversation. The question is, they have to go against those loud voices of opposition. You know, it's easy. You know, I've often said, when people say to me, John, what do you perceive to be the single biggest challenge that we face? I think the single biggest challenge that we face on issues of this type is the silence of the good people.
Whoa.
That's the single biggest problem that you face. I mean, I know many, many whites that I talk to, not only here, because I'm involved in a number of things, who say, yes, they really want to do this, but being able to go against that grain, that resistance in your community. Because keep in mind, when we talk about people who say someone is racist or racism, et cetera, et cetera, the one thing that we fail to understand, I think a lot of people fail to understand, racism is a power construct.
Correct.
You know, people can be prejudiced.
Correct. Anyone
can be prejudiced. But to be racist, you need to have some basis of being able to deny someone something.
Correct.
And African Americans as a group don't really have the ability to deny loans and education and jobs, et cetera,
correct,
et cetera. And so when you sit down and compare the two groups, you say, well, you know, what threats are there? Well, whites perceive the threat from African American fear. Our threat, our fear, our way of seeing that is, hey, you can deny me housing, you can deny me loans, you can deny me education.
The access, basic necessities
on and on,
of life.
Basic necessities of life.
Wow. Now, this is a big conversation. For those who are checking us out this morning, who are interested in learning more, how can they learn more about the Lynching Sites Project of Memphis and get involved?
go to our, we have a website and we have a Facebook page. Our website is lynchingsitesmemphis.org. Go to our Facebook page, which, and our Facebook page is Lynching Sites Memphis. But you can go to either one of those. And incidentally, on there, we have a on our website, we have a page called Resources. And there it is a listing of a lot of books that will give you what the true history is. And it's not a biased history that says we're trying to push a point of view. It's simply saying, here are the facts. You make the decision which way you want to go. And there are those people who will read that, they will see that, and they will stay right where they are. And fine, that's okay, because everybody's entitled to their opinion, however they got there. But there are people who generally want to understand what actually happened. How did we get to where we are? But you can make a donation.
I was about to ask you about that. A work of this nature is definitely historical in perspective. It's a nonprofit.
Right.
So you need support.
We need support. And you can go to the Facebook page. You can make or the website, either one, and make a donation. And it's made through the Community Foundation of Memphis.
Okay.
And I know people get very concerned about, well, wait a minute, what are you going to do with my money? But the Community Foundation of Memphis is really acting as our financial agent who monitors all of our expenditures. And we really do need the support. This is important work. And if I can, let me just share one other thing with you. And I know most of your listeners will know Representative Johnny Turner.
Correct.
Representative Turner was able to get the Tennessee legislation to pass cold case civil rights legislation in June of this year. What that did, it established a legislative committee, to study this, to make a recommendation to the full General Assembly. In fact, this month that's going to take place. It is focused on looking at old cold case civil rights, very similar to the Emmett Till Act. And I mentioned Representative Turner and Memphis because this is important work. But one of the spinoffs of that work, which may be even more important than trying to prosecute somebody that's 80 or 90 years old for a bombing or a murder, it is what it does for the youth to know that their government cares about them. We've done a number of appearances before the Tennessee legislature, before the committee, and one of the things that we've said to them is that it's important for a private organization could take this work on and do it, but it's more important to have the people who are elected, the government, do this because that sends a message to literally hundreds of thousands of young African Americans. Your life is important. Your life does count. And it's important to have the government say that because keep in mind, all of these lynchings that occurred, they'd occurred with some degree of the government looking the other way.
That is correct.
And I continue to say that I think one of the reasons we see some of the violence and the despair is because our youth look at the history and they have no sense of hope.
Correct.
And they look and say, well, wait a minute. You know, you lynched all these people way back then, but look at what you're doing just now. Look at Eric Garner. Look at Tamir Rice. Look at Philando Castile. On and on and on and on. So I think that's why it's important to have the government be the one. And I applaud Representative Turner. She paired with Representative Norris from Collierville to get this done. And it unanimously passed the legislature that they were going to do this. So I think it's these kinds of things that are very important to inform all of us going forward into the future, rather than the yelling that we do towards each other.
Wow, that is so important. Well, Margaret, do you have any final words?
Yes, I would like to invite anyone who is interested to attend our meetings. They are open. We welcome anyone with an interest to come. We meet on the second and fourth Mondays of the month at 5 in the evening. And anyone who's interested should check our website for details about exactly when and where we'll be meeting.
All righty. And Mr. John?
Yes, and I'd just like to add, if there are church groups who are listening, other organizations that are listening to this that would like to have a speaker, we have speakers available. We would be delighted because we really want to get out in neighborhoods and talk to people and inform them this is what happened. This is what we're doing.
Well, I am so grateful for this conversation and truly for the healing that needs to be happening in our community and in our country and in the world. So thank you all so much for your great work. And thank you all for listening to Positively Memphis. I'm your host, Christy Taylor.
Hey, this is your boy, D.L. Hughley. You know, Kings of Comedy, Comic View, The Hughley, star of stage, TV, movies. I could go on, but that wouldn't give me much time for what I'm most excited about.